Thank you very much for being here, though. This is something we do often at CSIS, but it's particularly valuable to have someone with Minister Lagarde's credentials and interest and experience and her understanding of this country as well as her own to have a conversation, to learn from each other, and to share some of our concerns, of which there are many. Peter, good morning. Christine Lagarde has been Trade Minister of France since June of 2005. I asked her this morning, I won't put it quite as bluntly as I did in the other room, but why she took such a job. Being in government these days is not the simplest of all things. But having people come to government with her experience is really important. And I just would give you a snapshot of that. She's been an accomplished lawyer, specializes in antitrust and labor law. She was previously chairman of the Global Policy Committee from 2004 and 2005 and chairman of the Executive Committee from 1999 to 2004 at Baker McKenzie. And everyone here knows of the extraordinary contributions of that firm. She's lectured in law at Paris X. One of the things that we talked about that I didn't see on the resume was that she co-chaired with Zbigniew Brzezinski the U.S.-EU Polish action, was that what it was called, action plan or action committee? And that committee just did some extraordinary things. It made an enormous contribution. Having had that experience was important for not just credentials, but for her own knowledge and her ability to demonstrate a capacity to make a contribution. I won't go through all of that. That was, by the way, a CSIS initiative, thanks to Zbigniew. It is important to have these conversations. It's also a wonderful testament to CSIS that people of this quality are willing to share their time with us. And I suggested that maybe we could begin with some reasonably informal remarks, as long as she wants. I may have a question following that. The two of us will be sitting up here. But the primary purpose is to let you participate, ask whatever questions you have, make whatever comments you wish. I will be a generous moderator to the extent possible and give you as much time as you want to ask a very remarkable lady what's happening. So may I offer her the lectern. We're grateful for your presence, Minister Lagarde. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Chairman. Ambassadors, ladies and friends, good morning. Bonjour à tous. I hope you don't mind, but I will start with a few reminiscences in front of a witness who has been helping me tremendously when I was co-chairing that committee. But it's been a great pleasure actually being back, because it did bring back those reminiscences of days when we did some good work together, helping out European countries of this world that at the time were learning their way and trying to make progress in terms of corporate governance, custom procedures and duties and the rest. So that was excellent training, and certainly memories are flowing back with a bit of emotion. I will start this very brief address with maybe a quote, if you don't mind, because I think that much smarter people than me have actually thought about those issues. And it's fascinating to see, very comforting as well, actually, to see that certain things never change. And I'm sure that we will conclude about change, which is also equally important. But I would like to quote somebody who's been heavily commented upon recently by some French writer who's been around around the country, actually, being driven, I'm told, and who commented upon Alexis de Tocqueville. And it is Alexis de Tocqueville in 1850, in L'Ancien Régime et la Révolution, who said this. Now, just close your eyes, think about 1850, what it was like in those days, what traveling was about, what changes were about. And he said this about his own country when he was himself traveling a lot and certainly experiencing tremendous encounters in this country. And there's nothing like being away from home to actually be extremely lucid, although very affectionate, about your own country. And he said this, considered in itself, France seems to me more extraordinary than anything else in the history of time. Has there ever been any other nation on earth which was so full of contrasts and extreme actions, prompted by emotion rather than principles, the most brilliant and dangerous nation in Europe, and the one best suited to become an object of admiration, hatred, pity, or terror, but never of indifference? Well, coming here today, and it wasn't planned, although you did tell me that my timing was perfect, I can certainly agree with Alexis that France does not lack contrast. And at a time when television, headlines, front page are portraying a less than flattering image of France, you may consider it strange for me to suggest that France, my country, could be a paradise for investors. Well, I do accept the paradox, because I believe that there are lots of preconceived ideas about France. And it is true that clichés, preconceived ideas, misrepresentations abound. Some are positive and will praise the excellence of France cuisine, gastronomy, wine, its genius for creating luxury designer clothes, cosmetics, leatherware, jewelries, its savoir-faire when it comes to savoir-vivre, and the charms of its landscape, sometimes, only sometimes, its inhabitants. It is the Brits who say that France is fabulous if it wasn't for the French. Other clichés, not so flattering, but not necessarily untrue, would highlight a certain arrogance, a nostalgia for past glory. Oh, Napoleon, here we go again. A difficult social climate. At the moment, I would find it probably hard to disclaim that there is some truth about it. And little liking for heavy-duty work, or just work. I would challenge that one. Now, the purpose of my talk today is not to deny all these clichés and to be, quote-unquote, in denial, as some journalists would argue today. After all, any cliché has a grain of truth. And the grain can be small, the grain can be large. And it can vary over time. It's just like us when we say that all Texans are terrific cowboys. Kings of rodeo, well, maybe. Or that all New Yorkers love their bagels in the morning. And that any Californian is a born surfer. Grain of truth, but cliche, maybe. What I would like to do, actually, this morning is offer you to take a step back and look at France, not just from that angle of the cliches, but from another angle, so that you can actually enlarge the spectrum, which will certainly enrich the vision. Now, you might disagree with it. You might not want to look at the whole spectrum, and you might prefer to stick to the cliches, but I think it's fair to accept, and I thank you for being here today to do that, to accept that there is a full spectrum and that all of it deserves attention. I'd like to start with globalization, because that's one where I think there is quite a bit of misrepresentation. And then I'll tackle innovation and creativity to take us a little bit away from this past glory liking that we are often portrayed with. Taking globalization to begin with, there's something called the sort of openness ratio, which measures how much an economy is open to foreign trade, to foreign direct investors. Well, the openness ratio of France is of 22%. And France, if you look at those ratios, is one of the most open country in the world. Many French businesses are established not just in France, but on all the continents. And it's interesting to note that of the top 100 companies of the world, 8 of them, and pretty much in the high end of the top 100, 8 of them are French companies. That's pretty good result. It's not 10%, but a little less than 10% for a population that accounts for only 1% of global population and for an economic power that is now the 6th largest economic power in the world, now that China has decided to take over the 5th position. Well, then, if it is so open to trade and to the world, why is it that France is so protective? Well, I'd like to challenge that. France actually supports very strongly, very heavily, multilateral trade, multilateral negotiations, multilateral agreements. Certainly more so than plurilaterals, and certainly more so than bilateral agreements that seem to be flavor of the day, not just as Plan B, but sometimes as Plan A, but by various countries. And if France is now portrayed, and I was personally associated with that nickname, portrayed as the watchdog of the European Commission, France is also a dedicated advocate of trade liberalization in both the industrial sector and in the service sector. France is very active in the agricultural sector, you will say, yes, but it is not promoting protectionism of agriculture or securing the common agricultural policy of the old days. France was an active participant in the reform of the common agricultural policy, which was decided in 2003 in anticipation of the WTO discussions that are taking place at the moment. Now, we can go back to that if there is interest in the audience in relation to that particular point, which I think warrants an explanation. But France certainly is a strong advocate of encouraging the trading and the export of all agricultural goods coming out from the least developed countries. I'd just like to pause for a second here to give you a little bit of an explanation of what the Everything But Arms agreement is about. And the Everything But Arms, EBA, was an agreement put in place by the European Union, strongly advocated by France, which opens all barriers, no tariff, no quota, to any exports from the least developed countries. And this has been in place since 2003. We were happy to, slightly convinced, I'm saying slightly because it was only 97% of it, slightly convinced all other developed countries outside the European Union to actually apply that so that goods coming out from very poor countries could access this country and Japan and a few others, as it does access the European Union territory, including France. So exports coming from the least developed countries of the world do come to Europe at zero tariff and without any quota. As a result of which, Europe alone buys more agricultural products from the least developed countries than all the OECD countries together, including the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, taken together as a whole. Not bad, not often mentioned. That's my very quick take on globalization, just to let you know that despite what is portrayed as this obscurantism, backwardness, we are actually very, very much so opened to international trade, and to globalization and to opening up our borders to those economies that will really draw benefit out of that. Focus on technology and innovation. And I just want to say a few words about that because, as I said, the cliché will propagate the image of a France that is attached to its tradition. Yes, we are. To its traditional sectors of excellence. Yes, it is. But it is also very much attached to developing technology, excellence in industrial fields as well. I'll just mention a few words. See if it rings bells for you. Ariane. The TGV, otherwise known as the high-speed train. Airbus aircrafts. Galileo. ITER. Those are a few of the projects that are not necessarily only French, but where France has certainly played a major part in engineering products of cutting-edge technology that actually work, or that actually fly, or that actually ride. And France is actually at the cutting edge of technological research and innovation in a whole range of areas. I'll tell you something. I was in Tokyo about 3 weeks ago, where there was a high-tech, very, very large exhibition. And I walked the floor of the exhibition, and I didn't feel really, really proud about the representation that we were giving to the rest of the world, because our booth and our visual identity and this and that was not, you know, top-notch. It wasn't equal to what the Brits had to demonstrate in some fashion, because they're pretty good at sort of polishing the outside, and we're not. Shouldn't say that. But when I went to a seminar room where the topic was biotechnology in particular and nanotechnology, I was shocked because the room was full of Japanese and South Koreans and a few other players in the field of nanotechnology. And I thought I had the wrong room number. And no, I didn't. The participants, the keynote speakers, the panel members were all French. And I spoke to a few Japanese representatives of very large conglomerates, such as Mitsubishi, Mitsui, and a few others. I said, well, why are you turning up in such a large group? And they said, because in quite a few niche areas in nanotechnology, France has the best that is on offer at the moment. They make no mistake. We are doing efforts to develop those centers of excellence. And clearly, whether it's in thermonuclear research, I mentioned ITER, I-T-E-R, which is this huge research reactor that is established in the south of France, whether it's with the nuclear power technology that certainly Areva masters like no one else and leads the civil nuclear power operating activity in the world. Certainly in those fields, France is at the top. In information and communication technologies, needless to mention the recent Alcatel-Lucent beautiful marriage that was portrayed on the front page of quite a few business newspapers a few days ago. Again, no surprise. The excellence marrying the excellence and forming a giant that will certainly rival with another giant such as Cisco. In that field of telecommunication, let's not forget either that French households have the highest proportion of IDSL connections in the world. Very wired, our good France is. Biotechnology and medicine. I'm going to be from Sunday onwards in Chicago, where the biotech huge, probably largest fair is taking place. There will be over 300 companies participating and demonstrating, again, their ability to research, to develop, and to actually master a few technologies in food, in the fight against major epidemics, and in drawing from the bioscience the techniques of the future. And in each of these sectors, I know it may come as a surprise to some of you who largely believe that research should be privately funded and the state should have nothing to do with it. The state should be about maintaining order, police, justice, and a couple of other things, regulating trade maybe on occasions, and throwing a few text about the employment market might be useful on occasions. But apart from that, don't get involved, don't mess around with research and development. Well, certainly France operates slightly differently, and we need to be tolerant of the way people operate. But in those sectors, France combines public and private research capabilities with the resource of world-scale industries. I'll mention three initiatives that were taken in the last 10 months to actually boost that innovation capabilities and that enterprise spirit that characterizes a lot of our engineers. Number one, the National Research Agency, which was endowed with a budget of 800 million euros in 2006 to finance upstream research programs. Number two, the creation of an industrial innovation agency, which is headed by the chairman of Rhône Poulenc from the private sector, which is, again, endowed with a budget of 1 billion euros in 2006 to assist businesses engaged in large technological programs targeted at buoyant markets. And finally, the approval of 66 clusters all around France, which comprise the business community, training institutes, research centers, and public authorities working on common projects in particular sectors that range from biotechnology to medicine research to port facilities to agro-business and on and on and on. And some members have argued that 66 is far too many for France, to which we have responded, many flowers. Thank you to the cherry trees. It was lovely being here today, actually, and I was told that I was late by 1 week. But we can let those flowers blossom. Some of them will flourish, we hope most of them. Some of them will not, but I can tell you that having travelled France a lot in the last few weeks, it's amazing what this cluster spirit has awakened in my country and has put people together that otherwise did not talk to each other very much. And as Minister of Trade, I'm delighted to see that some of the clusters are already linking up with clusters in the US, with clusters in Japan, with clusters in Germany, to actually share best practices and see where in common they can move their research capabilities to actually help humanity make progress in critical fields. These clusters are, and again, there is public money made available here because sometimes you need the seed money to boost progress, 1.5 billion euros in the form of tax holidays, reduce social security charges have been awarded to those clusters in order to help them just get started. These two choices of globalization and innovation actually reflect the resolve of France to be modern, to be not just going with the flock, but in some areas, not in all, but to actually lead the pack. And that's quite comforting to see in action rather than just on television or on front pages. Now, you might be asking yourselves whether French society actually wants this modernization or is willing to accept it, especially in the light of events triggered by the creation of an employment contract that was intended to lower unemployment amongst young people. And I will not try to convince you that French society readily, smoothly, quietly, peacefully accepts changes and the necessary reforms and adjustments. Yes, it creates frictions, it creates irritation, and it creates reaction. Has anybody seen television recently about the 1.5 million Brits walking down the streets of England to protest against the reform of the pension scheme in the UK? Probably not many of you. Does anybody know for how long the civil service in Germany has been on strike to protest against the increased working hours that is luckily proposed by Chancellor Angela Merkel? Probably not many of you. And how much coverage has there been about the hundred thousands of people marching down the streets of this beautiful country to protest against changes called for by the immigration situation. Probably not many of you, although that was coverage because it's home. Yet many of you will have in the back of their mind, or maybe in the front of their mind, these horrible French kids marching down the streets, breaking cars, setting fires to this, that, and the other, and knocking on other students when it's not the poor police forces. Why that is, don't ask me. I think there is something of this love and hate relationship that sometimes we've had with each other. There's more love than hatred, I can assure you, as far as I'm concerned. There's no hatred, actually. But this is something peculiar to the Franco-American relationship in a way, and it's more importantly and more to the point, something very peculiar about French and international medias, because it's just more fun to show something that is a bit sensational about a country that sometimes is regarded as a little bit pompous, a little bit arrogant, and which is often trying to teach the rest of the world lessons as to how things should be done because we do that better at home. But I would contend that this resistance to change is not the monopoly of France. And resistance to change is universal. It's a question of how long it takes, how it's implemented, how it's communicated, how the picture of tomorrow when the change has occurred is actually depicted, painted, and portrayed to those who are going to suffer change. Machiavelli has done that much more eloquently than I have, but he's the one who sort of lets you know about how much gain there is to be gained for the amount of pain that you actually are going to have to suffer. Having said that, what is also not very well known is the volume, amount, and significance of change that has already taken place. And I will use a few examples. I'll take the tax situation in France, which is often described as not a tax heaven, for goodness sake, a lot worse than that. Well, the two latest governments, that of Prime Minister Raffarin and the current government led by Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin, have certainly addressed the issue of tax in France. I'll mention just a few examples because you're not all tax lawyers, and I wasn't a tax lawyer, and I really cannot bore you with tax numbers and brackets and all the rest of it. But a few numbers. Number one, the business tax, which was a bit of an aberration in our French tax system, which penalized essentially those companies that invested in equipment and that employed people, because those were the criteria upon which business tax was measured. Well, that has been capped at 3.5% of the added value each year. And there is a complete exemption for those companies that actually invest going forward. Number two, a tax shield has been put in place this year, which is a shield against all taxes ranging from income tax to local tax to state tax, the overall tax burden that is suffered, not VAT, but everything else as far as personal income is concerned. The tax shield limits the overall tax burden at 60%. And that includes, obviously, the wealth tax. Now, you will say 60%, that's very high. Well, bear in mind that the income tax system has now been reformed as well. We now only have five different brackets, zero being one. So you can actually argue that there are only four brackets, four bands applicable to income. And the average income burden now is at 40% on income. Are we at a disadvantage? No, that's exactly within the margin that is applicable throughout Europe. So we are exactly at the average. Another example that I will take in the employment market. Not to be provocative, but I know that the employment market has often been described by various think tanks, by the OECD, by various observers who look at things without necessarily actually operating on the ground. But the employment market has often been regarded as rigid. Well, a couple of points. Number one, the working hours, which was rightly so criticized for having been reduced to 35 back in 1998. 35 hours, some of the Chinese would say, well, that's a part-time job as far as we're concerned. Well, back at home, it's a full-time job. But it's not the ultimate limit. It's only a threshold from which overtime is then calculated. And it's not overtime at the rate of 50%, as is calculated in this country. It's overtime at the rate of roughly 25%. It can be a bit less, actually, for very small companies. But it's overtime at a maximum rate of 25% up to the 43rd hour a week, after which, so from the 44th hour onwards, it's 50%. And companies can actually organize with union representatives and with employees' representatives. They can organize the working time. And if you actually ask any head of companies in France who is honest, most of them are, they will say that although the 35 hours were was a pain in the neck at the time when it was produced, it has certainly given huge room for flexibility within the working hours that it defines because of that ability to negotiate agreements and because of that reduction of the rate at which overtime is paid. Overtime being free up to 220 hours, when I say free, without any type of authorizations whatsoever, either from the authorities or from the employee's representative. Now, I have to say just a few words about these employment contracts that have been criticized and that are putting kids on the streets at the moment. The one that was initiated in August last year was the first attempt, successful, I hasten to add, the first attempt to relax the rigidity of the employment market by allowing all companies with less than 20 employees, and that's a very large number of our companies. We have a whole chemistry around the country, a whole network of small companies, to allow them to hire anybody without restrictions. Big deal, you will say. Yeah, big deal. But more importantly, to fire at will any employee, just in the same way as we have it here in this country, except that the heavy duty discrimination based on age, based on minority belonging and so on and so forth actually do not apply under French employment law. And I would suggest, actually, that a very small company in France is better off employing these people when it comes to flexibility than a US company of the same category. I might be pushing the ball a bit too far, but maybe not. And I will actually check on that. Now, you will say, that was good. And we thought it was good. We decided to carry on, and we put forward this latest employment contract, which pretty much allows for the same thing, except that we called it a probation period of 2 years and the ability to fire at will during that probation period for any company, small, medium, or large, for those employees that are under the age of 26, because we found out, just like any other European countries, that the unemployment rate that affects young people is double that of the unemployment average rate, and we want to do something about it. That's what has put a lot of kids on the streets. Whether it's totally genuine, whether it's part of the process of growing up, I mean, I marched down the streets more than 30 years ago, and I will confess something, I think Mr. Ambassador did as well. And I bet you that anybody who is French in this room may have been tempted to do so at one stage in his life. It's part of the process of growing up, in a way. And as I was, you know, I was visiting Switzerland last week, and the Swiss were saying to me, why on earth do young people walk down the streets of Paris? And I explained to them, I said, well, if we had 20 referendums a year, as you do, to express your views about any particular topic, including the most trivial ones, we probably wouldn't be marching down the streets. But that's just another way of, you know, expressing views. It might not be the most sophisticated one, but it's certainly one that is protected under any democratic system. The right to protest, the right to strike, is certainly part of our constitutional rights. Right. For those of you who have an interest in investing in France, given that my topic was France, a paradise for investors, I will mention very briefly a few numbers, which I think are great assets and certainly should be incentives for those of you who have money or who want to put more money into France, or who are counsels to those who would like to put money into France. Point number one, the geography, which is critical. It's clearly situated at the heartland of a market with over 460 million consumers, with GDP of over 10,500 billion euros all put together. I don't have the actual figure of the GDP per inhabitant, but I think that it's probably in the range of about 25,000 euros per inhabitant. And I'm talking here about the average, the European average, because the French GDP per inhabitant is about 30,000 euros. I mentioned to you earlier the amount of companies that we have in the top 100, and I was referring to its economic weight relative to its population weight. And it's interesting to see that with 5% of world GDP and only 1% of the world population, we are ranked as the sixth largest economic power, the fifth exporter of goods, the fourth exporter of services in the world. So sixth economic power, fifth exporter of goods, fourth exporter of services. Do I need to mention anything more or else about the infrastructure system that we have, whether it's road, whether it's railroad, whether it's airports? Those things actually work. They work quite well. Trains generally arrive on time. Now, you will say, when there is no strike. Well, the number of strikes is highly, highly inflated and certainly much more described than it is experienced by those of us who actually travel by train or commute by metro every day of our life. Now, I know it is sad, but whenever a foreign visitor or a dignitary comes to France, it just happens to be a day when people decide to go on strike. That's tough luck, but I can assure you that using those facilities on a regular basis, they do not have that that ranking. The French are lazy. They don't work hard. Rubbish, I would say. If you actually look at productivity per hour, the French are probably top of the list. I think in Europe, only people from Luxembourg rate higher than the French on a per hour basis. And if you look at all studies, actually, it seems that the French productivity on a per hour basis is 2% higher than US productivity and 16% above European average, 16% over European average. I was visiting yesterday with two tremendous chairmen. I'm saying they're tremendous because they, you know, listening to them was just music to my ears. I visited with Mr. McKinnell, who's the chairman of Pfizer, and with Mr. Inmail, the chairman of GE. And both of them said to me, I said, you know, I was coming almost humbly, apologetic about the way things are portrayed about France. And they said, no. You know, we're delighted. We're very satisfied with our business. We've been able to operate. We know that it's slightly more complicated, a little bit more time-consuming, sometimes a bit more expensive, not often. But it's very easy to operate. Restructuring can be done. There's no question about it. And by the way, we believe that the technical expertise of the workers and the ability of the management to operate a French team, a French manufacturing center, a French research and development center, is one of the best in the world. Now, I was not begging for compliments, and they didn't have anything to ask me. So beginning my day yesterday in New York and finishing my day in New York yesterday with each of these two gentlemen was actually extremely encouraging when it comes to the quality of the people that we have on the ground. And I can just see amongst your group that there are a few French people, actually, and I hope that they will feel some pride about comments made by others about our ability to actually operate, serve the purposes of a company. We talked about strikes, and, you know, it's often associated with the French and with France. If you look, however, at the number of days lost as a result of striking in the private sector. The number of days of strikes, I'm looking at my notes because I don't want to get that wrong. The number of days of strike per 1,000 employees is 25% lower than that in the United States. I know it comes as a surprise, but those numbers are from the OECD. Finally, setting up a business. And I'm referring here to the ranking produced by the World Bank called Doing Business. That's the Doing Business Report, which I will go and challenge a little bit this afternoon because it ranks France just about before Jamaica. Now, I don't know how many of you have tried to do business in Jamaica or have tried to recover a debt in Jamaica. I think there is something a bit funny and biased about the ranking. But I'll discuss that in details and very technically with them later on today. At least on the issue of how easy it is to set up a business, they agree that it is one of the easiest things in the world when you decide to set up a business in France in terms of costs, in terms of time, and in terms of number of procedures. Now, these measures that are sort of, you know, endemic or inherent to France or have been built over time are certainly encouraged by the reforms that I've described earlier when it comes to tax, when it comes to the employment market, and certainly when it comes to trying to attract investors from abroad. And I'll probably finish with that. The number of foreign direct investors in France, because I believe that there's nothing like facts and reality to defeat cliches and misrepresentations or misconceptions. In the last 5 years, France has always been in the top five countries that receive foreign direct investment in terms of volume and in terms of number of greenfield investments. So we can't be that bad. The amount of foreign direct investment in France in 2005 was 38.3 billion euros. Within Europe, France is the second most popular destination for foreign direct investment, just after Great Britain, but way before Germany, way before Italy, way before Spain. To encourage that investment, what we have tried to do is bring some unity. Now, that's where it becomes sometimes a bit complicated with us, the French. Because we have a tendency to think that individually we can do a better job, that we are smarter than the one next door, even if he is a national of the same country. And it's difficult to actually bring people under one single roof and to establish the principle of a one-stop shop. However, that's what we've accomplished with the Agency for Foreign Direct Investment, which manages investment from the source and is the gateway to any agencies that is needed in order to set up businesses, invest, buy land, operate, and on and on and on. I hope that with these, did you say brief? And I'm sorry that I wasn't brief. These comments, I was trying to at least not destroy the idea that you have about France, the cliches that are around, but I wanted to enlarge the spectrum, and I hope that I've done so. And I couldn't finish without, given that we talked about paradise or heaven, without referring to a lovely German saying, and those of you who speak German, I was hoping that Mr. Brzezinski might be around and he would have liked my German. I could have tried my Polish too, but that probably wouldn't have worked for long. Froh wie Gott in Frankreich, heureux comme Dieu en France, happy like God in France. So I don't know if the German saying is right. I have not experienced any particular visitation myself, but I can tell you that one can be extremely happy and successful in France. Thank you very much.
I was remiss in not introducing the ambassador, but I think I probably can speak for him in saying you probably would welcome a lot more visits like this to Washington. It would make your case very, very eloquently. Thank you and well done. It's hard to begin a conversation like this without moving away from an individual country and thinking about what we all face. In 1991, a U.S. business organization asked me to do a paper after I left the Labor Department on the impact of globalization. And this was before the Internet, before some of the other things that are accelerating the pace of change. And I did. I wrote it. I spent a lot of energy on it, and it was probably about 5,000 or 6,000 words. And I submitted it to them, and they refused to print it because it was too critical of American business, in saying that we simply were not facing the need to adapt as effectively by educating our own children. And I would make that comment today that we in this country are not in a position to criticize very much of anybody until we do a better job with our own public schools. We also are not exactly without sin as we try to promote the WTO and the Doha round. We have our own exceptions. So that's part of it. And I should add also that we'd be doing a lot less criticizing of the oil-producing countries if we had the nuclear power plan that France does. What is it, 80% of your power comes from nuclear? We have even put a spade in the ground since Three Mile Island. We panicked and we backed off, and we're paying a horrendous price right now. The problem that I see that both of us have is that the pace of change, which was horrendous in 1990, has accelerated dramatically. And it's really hard for an industrial society that has a democratic basis to its political system to get people to accept that pace of change. We don't want to do it here. They don't want to do it in Japan. The principal protesters in Doha and in Hong Kong were Koreans. They're not accepting that change very much either. But if you look at the world we live in, China is close to becoming the manufacturing center of choice for the world. India is close to becoming, at least in the lower areas of skill, the service center of the world. And France and the United States and Britain and an awful lot of other countries are going to have an interesting and challenging time maintaining our political stability as we try to address the exigencies of economic transformation that are mandated by the pace of change. And I was interested in your comment about the fact that we haven't seen these a million people in England. I didn't see that. I don't know who else did, but I didn't. Or in Germany, and I didn't see that. I don't know who else did, but I certainly didn't. It is, I think, true that all of us are struggling with these arguments that are more and more imponderable. The questions are not simple. The answers are increasingly complex, and they ask us to be able to think about things in new ways. That's hard to do. And I guess my first comment would be to commend you for the efforts, but to ask more of the philosophical question: what is it that we can do as industrial societies, as democratic societies? What can we do to help each other to get through this period? Because it isn't going to go away. We're going to have to face these issues for decades, and our children are going to have to face them. So while we can get angry at some of our partners because we disagree on some issues, and we will, and that isn't going to change, we have a stake in each other's well-being, and it's a big stake. What do we need to do that we're not doing that would open the door for more communication? Should ask this of a politician, but now you are one. So.
Well, I think of a couple of ideas, this is sort of a free thinking forum, which the CSIS is so good for. Number one, I think that there is a strong deficit of tolerance and confidence around the world, and any system that we can put in place to build confidence, to encourage tolerance, I think will be welcome. I don't mean to sort of put myself forward, but I certainly learned more about myself and about other human beings and the rest of the world when I had the benefit of being a scholar from the American Field Service and spent a year in Washington, D.C., attending Holton Arms School, of all places. I learned more during that year than during many years in elite schools learning the law. And I think that, it doesn't have to be Peace Corps, it doesn't have to be this, that, especially, but I think that encouraging young people to know about others and to know about the rest of the world and to be less parochial, less self-centered, I think is critical. You started your comment about education, and I think that's really critical. Of course, it's not going to help anybody win the next election, and it's not a short-term achievement. It's going to be a long-term battle. I was horrified, actually, when I heard Bill Gates in Davos say that, according to his research, the most popular topic selected by young American students was gym. And, I'm a sports person. I love my sports, but, it's concerning. And I'm sure we would probably have the same results in lots of other places, probably in my own country. Don't know. We haven't tried. But I think we need to, invest more in terms not just of money, in terms of energy, in terms of good people, in terms of talent in the educational system. And we need to bridge that with the economy, with the business world, so that there is the right connection and the right understanding between these two worlds, one leading necessarily, at least for portion of them, to the other. So I think, trying to build up tolerance and develop confidence by making sure that people develop the awareness about the other and educating people more, I think, is key. Now, those are long terms, and they're not going to solve anything, and I don't have the budgets to actually develop those projects. I'm just throwing ideas. In terms of business, I was traveling the other day with the chairman of Thomson, which is a big international company now, which has only 20% of its activities in France. And he was saying to me that with quite a few other fellow chairmen, when developing their strategic plan, they were looking at what the Chinese can't get, what the Indians will not steal. and that might be a little bit defensive, but I think there is value in identifying those areas of business, those segments of the economy that are either de facto or as a result of huge technology advance, protected from the reach of those that are currently hungry for a space in the world, be it business or otherwise.
That implies more education, though. Yep. I think, which is pretty basic. I won't stay on the philosophical thing. I think there are people here that have great skill in specific areas. So let me open the door for your comments. There are mics that will be brought to you right here. And
Harry Dunphy from AP, and sorry to bring this discussion down to the quotidien, but I'd like to know whether you think the WTO talks are going to make their end of April deadline, and whether the Europeans might come up with some behind-the-scenes proposals, as the German economics minister suggested yesterday, to get the talks moving, provided the Europeans get greater access to industrial goods and market access for industrial goods and services. Thank you.
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball to tell you about this April 30th deadline. All I can tell you is that everybody is getting ready for that deadline, that a lot of number crunching has been taking place in Geneva, in Brussels, and elsewhere, and that certainly a move, finally, at last, a move on the part of countries such as Brazil would be highly welcome. You know, we've been sort of waiting for the last, 18 months, but certainly the last year for, a teeny tiny bit of movement, and we're not seeing anything. So I think if and when such time comes, but clearly the onus, the focus, and the level of pressure should not be on Europe at the moment, and is not, actually. It should be on countries such as Brazil to actually demonstrate a willingness to some level of openness, which we haven't seen. So when that time comes, then it will be for us Europeans together, and the 25 of us, to discuss, see what position we take.
Please.
Madam Minister, George Handy, thank you so much for your comments at the outset about our International Action Commission program. We're still running on the momentum of your leadership. I'd like to ask you a question, if I could, about trade and counterfeit goods and intellectual property protection. You've mentioned the importance of innovation in France and its future. Trade today is being significantly degraded by the growth in counterfeit goods. It also is affected by the manner in which intellectual property is protected. It's a question of procedure, but it's also a question of values. It's an area where, in all likelihood, France would lead in both values and in procedures. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what's going on from your standpoint and what you might advocate to the global community.
George, thank you for the question. It's actually very much to the point, and to the point that you were referring to as well. The estimate around the world is that about 10% of the goods that are circulating at any given time are counterfeited goods. What's of really huge concern is that it does not only counterfeit beautiful Louis Vuitton bags or nice Cartier watches or Rolex or whatever, but it now affects every single industry, from spare parts for cars and airplanes to essential drugs, to electrical goods, to children toys, and on and on and on. And some of them are really a matter of health, of security, and of survival. In a country like Nigeria, for instance, about 70% of the drugs that are being sold are counterfeit drugs, and some of them are innocuous. That's all right, but some of them are actually horrible things that cause huge disease, injuries, and death. So clearly the global community has to do something about it. And it's not enough to have countries agree to comply with TRIPS, for instance, which is the intellectual property chapter of the WTO, but it's essential that those agreements be actually enforced, be executed, and that there be proper action taken at the local level in the furthest part of any country that is willing to comply with those rules. Actions are underway, some of them initiated by the United States, for instance, to ask countries to explain how they apply intellectual property rules and what is their track record. This is, you know, an information process that has taken place, which will be delivered against, and after which I think other members will decide what kind of action needs to be taken. And certainly France is extremely vigilant and is going to, you know, participate in that process. The other thing which we are doing, I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, in those countries of the world where there is either counterfeiting action or counterfeiting trafficking, I certainly try in any visit that I pay to those countries to raise the attention of the authorities, to try to organize seminars on the ground about those issues, so that, you know, by the same token, authorities are more willing to address the issue and to try to find solutions. We've also organized sort of swapping of teams where we put some of our custom officers and our custom trainers to the, you know, I'm remembering the old days when we were looking at concrete actions rather than, you know, deeds, not creeds. We are making those officials available to train and explain to countries that are joining this refined world where intellectual property is nicely protected, how it can be done, how raids can be conducted, how sanctions can be taken, how the police and the custom officers need to cooperate with the business people to really go after counterfeiting. And finally, because you have to really address the issue at the counterfeiting stage where the products are actually manufactured. You need to interfere at the level where there is distribution of products. And I think you also need to interfere at the level where there is consumption of such goods. And here we've launched, actually just a week ago, a huge advertising campaign, which will be all over France, to explain to the French consumers that by buying a counterfeited Louis Vuitton bag, or by accepting to buy a fake DVD, or buy, you know, those fake, not fake, but those counterfeited films or music, they participate in a process that is not only drawing illegal money, but which is also very often feeding those terrorist networks that benefit from the flow of money that is nicely laundered through those acts. So there will be an increase in that advertising campaign for those of you who will be visiting France, Germany and other places at the time of the World Cup, because we think that people are going to watch an awful lot of television and they will be seeing those ads at the same time.
Ernie? Ernie Prieg. I remember fondly my years at CSIS, but these days Manufacturers Alliance, a private sector think tank, and our 500 corporate members are large, multinational, and they're investing abroad. But number one country target is China and some other Asian countries. Relatively little, unfortunately, in a way, for Germany, France. But a major factor is the cost differentials, and a lot has to do with the exchange rate. And this is also reflected in our trade deficits, Europe and growing trade deficits, with China in particular, and particularly the very low-pegged yuan. And my question is, while the United States is pushing very hard to get an adjustment in this, Europe, EU, France, I'm not sure where, doesn't seem to be with us that strongly. And I only reflect this in a context, a historical context, where in trade negotiations, the EU and France, most of all, were always trying to link adjustment in imbalances in trade with trade liberalization. Specifically, I was still in government, Punta del Este Conference, 86. Europeans had this major initiative called Balance of Benefits vis-a-vis Japan. And informally, the press and we delegates were translating it to bash the Oriental bastards. That's what it was. We were on the Japanese side then. We preferred the bilateral route for whatever reasons. But what happened to this, the European linkage, particularly the French, between trade balances being moving in the right direction and trade liberalization right in WTO negotiations or elsewhere? Where are you today in this unprecedented imbalance? The U.S. seemed not with the Europeans on this issue.
To be clear, you're talking about basically the currency.
The currency imbalance, adjustment in
particular. The Chinese currency.
And also, more broadly, it's just the surging Chinese trade surplus globally. Its current account is now 7% of GDP and rising, the Chinese global current account surplus.
Well, I might be out of my depth on that one because I'm not in charge of the monetary policy and it's, you know, in many ways some of it has been delegated to the European Central Bank. And, you know, I think I'd be hard put commenting on that. Maybe we should all go back to Punta del Este. Not a bad place to meet, actually, and very conducive to agreement, especially if you sit by the pool and drink a nice whatever latte with something else. That's just an observation on my part. But any exhortation so far to the Chinese authorities, and I recognize that there's been more exhortation, certainly, you know, more vocal and visible exhortation by the U.S. Than by the EU, has produced, unfortunately, very little benefit. And we've had, you know, polite but pretty firm response lately by the Chinese authorities. So, I'd rather not avoid the question, but simply tell you that I'm certainly not the right person to address it properly. But I concur with you that the drawing advantage of a currency is one way to promote your trade activity. The currency adjustment is not part of the trade brief, so to speak. Maybe there will come a point where we'll have to ask ourselves whether, when there is such a differential and such resistance, it shouldn't be part of the ancillary topics that are actually covered. Will do. Promise.
Ernie, if you recall, and I think it was in 1983, because we were having so many issues that were unrelated to trade in the strict sense, but had direct impact because of currency imbalances, I suggested that we have the Rio Conference of Trade and Finance Ministers, and one finance minister who shall remain unnamed said, we're not going to participate in that. We don't do the grubby little business of trade. Finance ministers are notorious, and I won't go in what sense. But the truth is that with a country like the United States, as big as we are, we can't manipulate our currency. It just can't be done. It's just too big. But in a controlled economy, you still do have the ability to do that to some degree. And it seems to me that until we understand that currency relationships, unless they're free and open, unless the currencies are subject to market forces instead of governmental decision-making, we're going to have these problems. And China is just the most recent and most egregious example. The thing that worries me is if you look at the cost differential in terms of manufacturing production, particularly when the senator from New York suggests we ought to impose a 27.5% tariff on all Chinese products, that won't solve the problem. It would take more than that. And instead of doing something that draconian, which would be enormously destabilizing to China, to the United States, and to the world system, having a currency free to float would allow these adjustments to take place regularly and predictably, and we could make our adjustments. But it is really hard to separate trade from finance, and that's what we continue to do. We live in an illusory world when we do it. Hard.
May I add something?
Please.
Yeah. I was just reflecting on your question, and there are three little things that I want to offer. Number one, and that's back to George's question about intellectual property. The Chinese are now reaching a point of their development where they are building brands, where they are registering trademarks. I'm not sure that patent is something that is yet completely familiar to them, but certainly in the areas of brand, visual identity, multidimensional trademarks, they are making progress, and I think that's going to probably be the best way for us brand owners of other countries to actually make sure that intellectual property is respected on the ground. That's number one. Number two, for those of you who travel regularly to China and who have done so, who will do so, try always to ask what is the price per square meter or square foot. In Shanghai, in Beijing, in various cities, you'll be surprised to see how high it is and how fast it is moving up. So in terms of production costs, yes, it will still be cheaper to set up a manufacturing plant in one of the eastern provinces. But is that where, you know, high-value business is going to be set up and operated? Not sure, but certainly some of the production costs are going up. And in terms of management talent or highly skilled labor, the costs again in the pockets of the country where the investors are looking at investing money, the costs are going up and rising very fast. So maybe we're just playing a catch-up game where time is going to be of the essence.
Managing the change is going to be challenging for our political system, though. Back here, please. The lady. Sorry, I'll come to this side of the room next.
Yes, hello. Yvette Saint-André from the U.S. State Department. I was wondering, I assume you have read in detail this week's cover story on The Economist on France, and, oh, you haven't. A pity. Oh, really? Well, it sets out a thesis that France is divided, and its inner story says France, a tale of two Frances, actually, and it sets out a thesis that there is a dichotomy between civil service France and private sector France, and that's part of what's causing the current frustrations. Since you haven't read it, perhaps you have no thoughts, but if you do, be very grateful if you would share them.
I think one of the efforts that is underway and that we, I hope we will continue pushing, will be to try to establish more bridges, to have more sharing between the various worlds. And clearly the sort of high-ranking civil service system that has served France so well for many years is probably at a stage where it has to also link up, bridge with, be part of the industrial, the economic, and the business texture of France. That is certainly underway. The political will expressed that by Dominique de Villepin to also establish a bridge between education and the educational system and the business world is critical in order to reconcile particularly young people with the business world, with enterprises, with the boss, who is not necessarily this horrible capitalist that is here to exploit you to death.
I was, and when we were conversing before, I was reminding, I told the minister, listening to the radio driving in from Annapolis this morning, talking about the disconnect between government and people. There was an angry caller talking about the immigration bill in the United States who suggested that we should deport the Congress and let the immigrants stay because they work. I haven't seen the president lately, and I don't think I'll tell him that story, but they're over here. And Catherine, you next.
Gary Littman, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Over the last 12 months, we've been hearing stories from Paris about possible introduction in France of class action lawsuits against companies. Has your ministry done an assessment what this might do to the French investment paradise?
Well, assuming he had not done so, I would certainly welcome you to visit with him to let him know your views about it. I think I know what your views are for having shared war stories with your president. I think it is looked at. I don't think that it's going to be implemented and inserted in our procedural system, certainly in the existing format that works or doesn't work, depending on how you look at it and from which point of view you stand in this country. And I come from a world which in some ways has benefited hugely from class actions. Certainly my firm, sorry, I'm just for a microsecond putting my previous hat on, my firm has never, ever benefited from class action. And we've had to help and sometimes pull out of virtual bankruptcy companies that were the subject of class action. So I have very, very biased and very special views about class action. But I'm not in charge of the Ministry of Justice at this point. So, but I will pass on your views, which I suspect I know what they are.
There's one American that agrees with those views, I'll tell you that. Go ahead. Catherine.
Thank you. I'm Catherine Hauser with the Transatlantic Business Dialogue here at CSIS. Thank you for being with us this morning. It's a very interesting conversation. I'd like to take us back to the innovation point. It was very interesting to me that in talking about the issue, you focused only on the public-private funding of R&D. And I'm really interested to find out what you're doing on the, in my view, really the more important step of innovation, which is how to commercialize these technologies. What kind of programs do you have underway in France, or what are you trying to do to encourage entrepreneurs to take the risk, which is, of course, critical to commercialize the technologies and finance these startup companies so that the inventions being developed in the labs can actually have some broader meaning and applicability in the marketplace?
That's a very, very good point. And I will admit partial ignorance on the second element of my response, but maybe Mr. Ambassador will give me a hand. If not, then I'll make sure that you get the numbers right. Number one, the cluster concept was precisely intended to deal with that issue. And, you know, to talk about it and to sort of intellectually assume that it's a great idea is one thing, but to actually go in the field and talk to the people who are setting up those clusters, who are identifying the projects that they want to work on, and to hear them say, I'm talking here about the researchers, the people that do sort of fundamental research, say, gee, I had no idea that this particular project would actually be of interest to such and such companies. And now that we've talked and we've looked at market research and that we've looked at their strategic plan and where they see the market going, I'm now convinced that I should carry on researching that rather than this, or this rather than that. So the sort of the connexity, mixity, the proximity, whatever you call it, the glue between these people is actually producing the right focus on what will take the journey that is necessary between the idea and the products. Now, from the product to the market, you're talking about a second journey, which requires funding. And on that one, and that's where I might be missing the number, because and I don't want to get that wrong, but the insurance companies have been required to invest in a fund. Insurance companies are very wealthy companies generally. They raise a lot of funds, and, you know, with God's blessing, we don't have too many catastrophes, and they can just roll on and be reasonably happy. So the president has asked the insurance companies to identify a percentage of their reserves that will be specially dedicated to the equivalent of a business angel's function, where they will actually help fund those startup companies that actually have worked out the project, have the business plan, have the strategy, but don't have the money to do the last bit of the journey, which is from product to market. And I don't want to give you the wrong percentage, but I'll be happy to come back to you on that.
I think we're going to have one last question, please.
Madam Minister, Mario Brossi with the Swiss Foreign Investment Agency. You come from a wonderful country, and you represent it tremendously well. We'll be happy to share our initiatives and referenda with you. Just let us know how many you'd like. One quick question, if I might. I think there's a view developing, certainly here in the United States, that France champions a belief in national champions. Of developing large companies or protecting existing large companies to the disservice of a potential foreign acquirer. You talked earlier about perceptions and misperceptions. Would you call that an accurate perception, or is that indeed a misperception?
I think any country would take pride in champions and those that are, you know, trying to not only carry the flag but sell the products and promote the ideas and hopefully make the shareholders happy back at home. To talk about national champions is actually in and of itself, I believe, somehow a misconception, but maybe it's a misrepresentation of what national is about when it comes to identifying a company. Because if I look at the our top 50 companies, I would bet you that probably 90% of them are largely owned by foreign shareholders, pension funds and the like, are heavily invested outside the country, with some of them having as much as 80% of their activities, turnover and employees alike outside of the country, and that their strategy is probably to expand way beyond the national borders. So, and it's in that sense, and I'm not trying to avoid your question, and I can think of a couple of cases that you probably think of where the government has positioned itself against such or such attempt to take over the control of a particular group. But I think that the whole concept of relying on national champion is probably not exactly accurate, because national is not national. National is international. National is global, and the market is the world. And those French companies that were originally French, or that are perceived as French, including by the French public itself, are international breed, and they go about the world.
That's such a terrifically important point. I mean, the xenophobic response of the United States to the Dubai issue was pretty classic. And I show you how misguided we can be on occasion in our public response to a snapshot and a frankly an inaccurate press story. That's the danger we live in, and I think something we have to pay a lot of attention to. We've had some terrifically interesting conversation this morning. I could stay for a long time, but the minister has other obligations, and I want to express on behalf of all of us our appreciation for a wonderfully articulate and able presentation. Francis Chosenwell, again, we thank you so much for being at CSIS, and Mr. Ambassador, you too. And thank you all for your being here. We enjoyed it. Thank you.